Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 13th, 2000. In the fireside room this morning is Gaylord Thomas. Today's session number is 2002, and it's titled, What We Have Done and What We Have Left Undone, Faith-Based Community Organizing. Let's listen in.
Their main organization. And after we survived the human sexuality study, things were pretty cool in the church. And that was before the CCM thing started, so I don't know. But anyway, truly it's a blessing to have this job and to work in this arena and to be a Lutheran. And I didn't always feel like that. I was confirmed in 1959, and there was a period during the Civil Rights Movement where I didn't feel like the church was proactive enough, so I stepped away. And then when my first wife and I divorced, I had a shared custody agreement, and she moved in with her sister, and her kids were going to Lutheran school. And I picked the kids up one day, and they said, we were driving down the street, and the son in the back said, he was about six, he said, Dad, Mark came home from school and said that when you get to be 100, God will come and take you away. And so I was smiling a little bit, and then he said, and then he got real concerned, he said, and then where are you going to be? And I wanted to laugh. I said, I've been gone when you get to be 100. But I realized that my little son, Chad, was crying his eyeballs out. And so I stopped the car, went to the telephone booth, called Max, said, I got to get some church stuff because I got to take these kids to Miss Bullock, who was my Sunday school teacher, to get some of this stuff straight. So we went to church that Sunday, and I got them all dressed up, and they had little apples, and I picked their hair out and brushed their shoes and took them in and dropped them off, and then I went somewhere else. So I came back and picked them up, and I said, oh, it was church. Oh, it was all right, it was all right. So we drove about a block, and they said, but you know, God wasn't there. You know, they kept saying, this is God's house, take your hat off, this and that, but he wasn't even there, they knew us, Dad. So I thought that was good. But that's what got me back in the church. I started today with the Domestic Homeless Fund of the Year of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America funds in three arenas. Direct relief, community development, and the last one that we're going to talk about today is faith-based community organized. And that's what we're going to talk about. And I'm going to give a little overview, and I feel comfortable I can say anything because Jody Preston back there will correct me. A simple analysis of what faith-based community organizing is, it's about organizing for power, and it's about people coming together with shared values, addressing power, and we define power as organized money, organized people in this country. And there's three or three and a half different versions of organizing. You got single issue organizing, and probably one of the best examples of that in modern day times is, I don't know if you're familiar with this African-American brother named Amaya, and I'm not pronouncing that right, but who's on death row in Pennsylvania for apparently killing a cop. And they have done an incredible job of organizing. That boy had been in the gas chamber a year ago. But they've had rallies, he's published, he even addressed the Northwestern graduation, some I understand.
Evergreen State.
Right. That's incredible for somebody sitting on death row. But it's because of that consciousness of organizing that has kept him alive. Well, that's sort of like a single issue organizing campaign. And then the second type of organizing that we're probably more familiar with is institutional organizing. And in most cases, that's the AFL-CIO and UAW and other union type of organizing. And then the third type is what we call broad-based organizing, where we come together for issues and continue organizing. After we settle this particular issue, we go to another one. And that's done in two ways. I guess in the 70s, when the communities, white flight or whatever you call it, when the city started, the central business district started to decline in our cities, the only existing healthy institutions in our communities were the churches. So Sol Alinsky and some of the early folks in this organizing, we realized that if they wanted to make a real impact, they needed to start working with the churches. And so we have a model called broad-based, faith-based community organizing. And another deviation for that is that there's broad-based individual organizing. There's an organization well known in this country called ACORN that goes door to door, on the street, signing things. They're real effective But it's not the faith-based organizing model. Susan B. Anthony, Rosa J. Parks, Gail Sincotta, individuals, the power of one, three women committed to their causes. The one thing that they had in common, all three of them were pissed off. and you got to deal with that. You know, you got to deal with that because part of the organizing model is well-guided anger. You know, you don't get anywhere in this country running around smiling all the time with folks. You got to have something that drives you. And these three ladies, they had it. They had the fire. And I think that's an excellent example of how one can make a difference. You know, we sit back and don't think we as an individual can make a difference. And these folks made differences. And it wasn't as spontaneous as we might think. You know, people think that Rosa Parks just got tired and sat down on the bus in the wrong section on December 20th, the Cleveland Avenue bus. But the reality is, she had been to the Highlander Center in Tennessee, which is a Danish folk school, leadership school, Miles Horton founded. She'd been training for years before that. It was just that particular day when she'd had enough. You know, Gail Sincotta said, "I'm not moving no more. I'm not leaving Austin." We know Gail Sincotta is the one person that they accredit the CRA movement to, the Community Reinvestment Act. And you know, as African Americans moved from the central part of the city further out to the periphery, the outer rings, the white people moved further out, and she was just at a point, "I'm not moving anymore, and I'm gonna do something about it." And it's interesting because I think that's a good example that leads me into three of the most important things about organizing that I think the church needs to pay attention to. And that point is, one of the points is pastors in the church, you know, the Lutheran is a guilt-driven church. And we use that, you know, and pastors pass that guilt on almost every Sunday to the congregation. And so they create problems that are immense, you know, enormous problems. And some of us come out of it depressed saying, "My God, how can we change the world with all this?" But the reality of organizing is you look into that problem and find the issue that's winnable, that you can deal with. A good example I use that's old is in California 7-8 years ago, they realized that one of their problems was underemployment, you know, and there's a whole lot of factors that feed that. So the issue that they cut out of that was, let's change the minimum wage. You know, but and so Gail Sincotta in her struggle, she said, I want to invest back into these communities and keep them healthy and not just create more and more slums. You know, where there's another lot of other issues in why folks leave cities and all that. So cutting an issue out of a problem is critical. And the second part of this whole piece of organizing I think is very important is deciding what is winnable. And starting where you are, and starting where the people are, and moving beyond that. The third most important part of organizing that I think is the most important part for the church, especially in light of this arena, and probably the second half of this presentation done in a more professional way will be done by Andy Gordon as he talks about technology. But one of my fears is that we're moving so fast, and in this technology age, we're ignoring relationship building. You know, and it was interesting when I was in, I was in the Philippines in the early May. There was something on TV about, and I don't remember the authors, but they were talking about love letters on the internet. You know, and so the final analysis was it's just not the same. You know, rather opening that letter and reading it is a little bit different than reading the love letter on the internet. And so I'm glad somebody woke up to see something different. But it's very important, you know, and we get romanced by this whole technology and this email and this fax thing. But I guarantee you though, if you send 10 emails out to folks and invite them somewhere, and those same 10 folks you went to talk to for 5 minutes apiece, you'll get a better response from that physical contact. And I know it's more labor intense and stressful, but we still have to do it. And especially in the church, we got to continue to be in people's faces. There's a verse in Luke that talks about Jesus and them coming down from Mount Olives. And at the beginning of the verse, it's that part that says, the Pharisee runs to Jesus and said, you know, tell the disciples to shut up. And Jesus said, if I tell them to shut up, the stones are going to cry out. And then if you go a little bit further down, it says, as Jesus entered the city, as he drew near the city, he began to wept, for they did not know the things that make for peace. And the piece of that I focus on is that Jesus got near the city. You know, I mean, he came down with the people, smelled the stench, and sort of felt their pain. We can't remove ourselves. We can't continue to remove ourselves from the city. And we do it without moving out the city. And it's not just white churches, it's large middle-class African-American churches and other denominations. If you look at the historical black churches in the black ghettos, they got big parking lots with 7-foot fences and Constantine wires around them too. So obviously they're not relating to that community. But it's important that we understand what this one-on-one process is. And so I'd like to indulge you for a minute in a little exercise. And I would like for you not to be with anybody that you slept with last night. So when you pair off. So I'd like you to start down here and do 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2 around.
1, 2. 1.
Okay, don't show anybody your piece of paper. And the objective of this exercise, I want you to find a 2 and find this information out without asking it, without asking a specific question on that sheet. So find a number 2 and engage them in a one-on-one and find this information out without specifically asking the question. You understand?
No.
You know, what are you?
I forget.
you just listen to who's talking. Just follow the leader. Okay? 5 minutes. 5, 10 minutes. Just pair off.
So 1 is after 5 and 2 in the morning.
Okay. How many of you got your answer?
What?
How many of you got the answer to the question? Almost everybody, huh? Margo's still working on it. What else did you find out on the way? Go ahead.
Should we ask them if we did get the right answer? I mean, I think I've got the answer, but should we ask them to check it out?
Oh, you can ask them what the question was. Sure. Everybody got the same question? I didn't mix them up.
Everybody got the same question?
They did?
No.
No, okay. The point of that little exercise was in a one-on-one, in most cases, the way it operates is that you sit down with the original circle, excuse my memory, whatever that first group was called, and plan a strategy. And usually a pastor will tell you, well, he'll identify 5 or 6 people in the congregation that you go out and talk to and start this process of one-on-ones and trying to deal with, find the intersect points and find the values and the issues that are important. So you know these people, they're not totally strangers, so it's not like you're not gonna answer the door because the pastor told you that Andy's coming by to speak with you for a minute. So we start. But the other point of this process is that, what else did you find out on the way to find the answer to the question? Did any of you find any interesting information out about the individuals other than the point of question?
That's
what
you have to really get to know
to ask
such a personal question.
That's right.
Well, what were the questions in general? I mean, if people didn't have the same question,
did you brush your teeth this morning? Do you wear deodorant? Did you have a bowel movement? Did you brush your teeth last night? Did you have a bowel movement this morning? Or was it last night in one or the other? I think that was, I just had 4. All right. Any other interesting conversations about the conversation? About what you might have learned from the individual? And see, when you take that to the next level, what you come away from that conversation learning is find out how much you relate to this person, how many points of intersect that you share. You know, an example of organizing that is opposite of what we're talking about is in California when they had to build, was it 220 or 202? The bill that is a 209 when they're talking about undocumented people not having access to government.
Oh,
yeah. Is that the one?
That was a different one.
Well, anyway, whatever the bill was, people came together for all the wrong reasons. The businessmen downtown Los Angeles supported it because they didn't want these Latino kids running up and down the street. They wouldn't be in school disrupting their businesses. So they all came together and merged to defeat this bill. But after that, where'd they go? You know, because we don't share the same values. And so that's what's different about what we're trying to do with faith-based organizing. I'd like the two individuals that have the reading now to start, please.
Democracy is one form of government, pure and simple. It depends on some key institutions: elected leadership, more than one party, a balance of power. In the case of the United States, that means three branches of government.
But lots of countries have impressive institutions of democracy, and still the majority of citizens live in misery. To work, democracy has to be more. It has to be a way of life, a way of life that involves the values and practices people engage in daily in all aspects of their public lives.
Sure, it depends on some practices. The citizen has to vote, for example. The public official has to be honest. But the great thing about democracy is precisely that it doesn't require very much from citizens, leaving them free to pursue their private lives. That's really what matters to people.
Citizenship is a lot more than voting, and our public lives are much more than just our ties to government. Politicians are not the only people who live in a public world. Every one of us lives in a public world, but our public lives are rewarding for ourselves and our society. To the extent that we have a real say in the workplace, at school, in the community, in relation to the media, and to human services, as well as in government.
But democracy isn't about what goes on in the workplace or school. These institutions are protected by democratic government, but they certainly aren't the same thing as democracy. Furthermore, your ideas turn ordinary people into decision makers. Democracy works best when people elect others who are better qualified to keep the machinery of government running smoothly.
Citizens ought to determine the values upon which the decision makers act. It's those so-called experts, people who are supposed to be better qualified, who have gotten us into the mess we're in now. Experts don't have to be on top making the choices. Instead, they ought to be on tap to citizens who are choosing the directions our society ought to go in.
But most people don't want to be involved. Public life is no picnic. It's nasty and getting nastier all the time. In a democracy...
people. It's 7-day training, 2-3-day trainings, 10-day trainings, the most famous. All the stuff that organizing is done in the church, everything from more lights in the park, more police protection, better emergency response, bond referendums, bills, housing, all the issues that they do. The important piece for the church is what happens to those individuals that go through training and become leaders. Most of us believe that it's one of the most effective, on-the-job, in-process leadership training that we've experienced, especially in the last 20 years. And so that's the piece of, I used to say that the byproduct of organizing that impressed me was leadership training. And they corrected me and said, that's the primary focus. It's not the issue or the action. It's the leadership training piece. But we haven't grasped that. You know, we haven't, matter of fact, we don't even recognize those leaders. Sometimes in our church, we label them as agitators and troublemakers. You know, and we don't know how to encourage and support those leaders yet. And I think that's the piece that's undone in our work. We have to recognize them and respect them. Even though we might be in the box, we might be very linear people, we got to recognize the gifts of those folks. And a perfect example of that is a hero of mine and a hero of everybody's now, but wasn't originally, is this young boxer from Louisville. His name was Cassius Clay. He changed it to Muhammad Ali. Everybody in the world just thought that this was a fool. And who opened up the Olympics? You know, I mean, who's been on the cover of Sports Illustrated more than anybody? And we applaud him for his courage against the war. But at the time, he was so far out the box that most Americans didn't want to do it with a Muhammad Ali. I thought it was also impressive when the women's soccer team won last summer, and the girl took her shirt off in excitement. You know, the world came back and said, oh, that was an advertisement. That wasn't an advertisement. She's just on fire. She was full of it. You know, those are out-of-the-box people. Those are people that are very creative. And they're the folks that are going to make a change in this world. You know, it's not us that conform and follow the rank and file. It's those that want to step out that box. And the leadership, you know, there's two ladies that we showed on the video yesterday, Lorraine Lett and Gertrude Rogers. One of them was at a Lutheran congregation, Our Redeemer, Linden Boulevard, Brooklyn, and Lorraine Letts on Fullerton and St. John's in the Bronx. And they got involved in this organizing. They were people who would not stand up tough. You know, they would not stand toe-to-toe, you know, and be argumentative with individuals. And both of them have had Mayor Koch on the line, Mayor Dinkins on the line, and talked to them straight, you know, and back and forth in the dialogue. But now, of what they've done, I think is the gift. And if we're going to grow as a church, we better harness some of this leadership and know how to use it as a church. And pastors need to be aware of what that is, because it's critical to us. We started out in organizing, I don't know, 20, 25 years ago. Joey's a lot older than me, if I'm wrong in dates. But we started out, and one of the big organizing efforts right after QCO, Queens Community Organizing, I think was the first real visible Lutheran involvement in community organizing. We left there, we had so many successes, we felt, well, we need to bring this to Pittsburgh. Right after the Mon Valley issue and the Rust Belt and all that, when the steel mills shut down, you had these tons of steel workers that just were out there, weren't trained for anything else, didn't have any resources. So the church brought organizers in to help address that. And it was working. I mean, they were doing stuff. So when they got to the second or third level of that and started going to the banks and the financial institutions saying, look, you know, we got to advocate, we got to find some money and capital to support these people and a ton of issues, they realized the person sitting on the other side of that desk was a Lutheran, because we're a middle-class church. So, you know, we got Lutherans advocating, and we got Lutherans, so we ran dead into each other. We do that a lot in this organizing. The problem is we use the wrong troubleshooters to come in. We use the wrong people to come in and mediate the problem. And what they did is exacerbate the problem, and it got a lot worse. And finally, the final event that just killed the whole thing was on Easter Sunday, organizers just trying to make their point, trying to sensationalize it, went to the largest Presbyterian church. Matter of fact, it was either the Carnegie Church or the Mellon Church in Pittsburgh on Easter Sunday, and took animal blood and threw it on these people. And, I mean, they put dead animals in mailboxes. They actually took one of our Lutheran churches that in the Constitution of our Lutheran church says those present in that church that day can vote officially as a congregation, and they actually took a church from the Senate. And it took us about 7 years to get the congregation back. But anyway, with that experience, Lutherans have been a little bit hesitant about being involved in organizing, at least at the higher echelons, at the grassroots, it hasn't had as much effect. So we had a conference in 1992 to address that, you know, a healing conference that we're going to get this out on the table and we're going to deal with it. And so it was a great conference. People still talking about it. The tape you're getting ready to see came out of that conference. I think we published it in 1992. And I think we're in our second printing. We're over 11,000 tapes being distributed. So it was a very effective conference. So we came back together we came out of that conference saying what we need to do is attempt to bring Lutherans across any of the four networks involved in any organizing together so that they can start building relationships, just the Lutherans involved. Well, the networks are so fickle and I don't even know how to describe them. They didn't want that. You know, the networks, these organizers are tremendously talented people, but they got ego problems, real ego problems. They do, because if you ask anybody from the Industrial Area Foundations, what about PICO? Who is PICO? They've been organizing 25 years, and they don't know who the competitor is. That's garbage. So it was difficult getting them to come to sit at the table with us and say, look, we got to work this out. Plus, the other part of it, we as church people, denomination people said that we were reacting to that. Remember, we woke up that morning and the Republicans had taken the Congress, you know, and the mainline denomination said, woo, we've been out organized. Ralph Reed has done a job on us. And so at that time, us in the denomination said, well, one of the things we need to start doing is we need to start building regional, statewide, and even national strategies. Because you got networks, you have a network in Seattle doing something, and a network in Tacoma doing something, and they don't know each other, they don't work together, they don't try to bring any collective group together. Well, the organizers resisted it. I'm not sure why they resisted it, but I guess they thought it was a con or whatever. But we continued, and so we started to bring pastors across networks together within the Lutheran Church and create a theology that supports the organizing, writings and sermons that help it. And then we had a conference in February at Daytona Beach, and we brought about 150, 180 people together. We had three bishops, three or four seminarian presidents. And so the theme of it was to look 20 years back in the organizing Lutheran involvement and then look 20 years forward in what we need to do. And we wanted the bishop there, but he couldn't make it, so we had scheduled a 2-hour meeting with him on Ash Wednesday. And so a delegation of 14 folks met with the bishop, and we talked about some of the things that we wanted and thought. And one of the things we asked for was to meet with the cabinet of execs of the ELCA, and he got that done real quick. And so Monday before coming here, we, seven of us, met with the cabinet of executives of the ELCA, the division heads, which was a very powerful meeting. And so one of the things that has come out of this is that probably in the next 2 or 3 years, it's going to be mandatory for anybody in the seminary track to go through 10-day training or 7-day training, one of these leadership trainings in community organizing. And I think that's a real breakthrough for the church. I'm going to stop and run the video, and we'll have a discussion.
Go to the Lutheran loans officer, and there's the clash. Now what?
Well, I mean, the process of it is, I mean, first of all, the process of it, I mean, the radical part of that is what they did in the Civil Rights Movement and anti-war movement. I mean, if you can't get the bank's attention, regardless of if I'm the organizer, I'm moving with the flow of what the people have said. So we have to get the bank's attention. Now, the radical side of that is we're going to threaten to shut your bank down. Everybody's going to bring in 5,000 pennies and line up and have our pennies counted and deposited, so that you can't do any more business in the bank. So that's one piece of it. We gotta bring the attention. That person sitting behind that desk, that commercial loan officer sitting behind that desk, if we're doing what we need to do, he needs to be struggling with some stuff inside, depending on where his spirituality is. He needs to hear this issue and understand what they're doing wrong. Secondly, if he's hearing it on Sunday and the pastor's talking about it, and half the congregation is saying, hey, buddy, you got to lighten up, you know. It touches them. I mean, that's partial response. But there's no answer, and that's the struggle. But the reality is that we got to accept that struggle. I mean, we got to recognize that this agitation is healthy, and that at the end of it, something positive is going to come.
I'd like to engage the ELCA, you know, in more of a discussion about this, because I know I served for a while in the board of the Division for Church and Society, which is the board, the part of the ELCA that Gaylord works in. And I know that we get letters every so often in that division of the church from parishioners, people in the pew who say they don't want their benevolence dollars going to do organizing, whatever that is, radical, you know. They say, I don't give money to do that for my church to do that. I would not give money for my church to
feed people
and to do missionary work, you know, among the poor overseas, or, you know, they have some idea of the church that does not include community organizing or church-based organizing. And so, I wonder whether there are other people here who have, you know, mixed feelings about this or qualms about it, or if everybody here just thinks, you know, I mean,
Let me just put a personal piece out there.
What does it mean to be the church, I think, is a good sort of what I'm thinking about.
personally, and this is a non-ELC official comment, but personally, a piece of that is right. You know, even though I'm against the letters and I take a beating every year after the letters go out about that, a part of it is right simply because we say hunger fund. And the church is so fickle because of the financial problems we had starting off. You know, if it ain't broke, they won't fix it. So the hunger fund has been growing for 13 years. There's only 1 year that we lost money. So they won't change the name. You know, I think that the answer to that, if you say relief and development, you know, or like Campaign for Human Development's name or Self-Help People's Fund, then our integrity would be better served. But some of that is right. You know, you say hunger and food. I don't agree with the relief angle, but you say that, and then you're going to give it to this guy who's agitated. But anyway, somebody else wants to jump in.
Sometimes I wonder, and I think people I know also are concerned that it seems like our evangelism and our social ministries work separately instead of together. At least that's perception. Like, I was wondering when we saw the video the other day on the Nehemiah Project, do the people that live in those homes know that these are put together by Christians, by people who know Jesus, and that, you know, I think sometimes people get concerned that we're doing all this good, but it doesn't point back to Jesus?
Well, the people in those homes know, for sure. Yeah, because see, it's not just simply you buying a home. You got to buy it to be a membership of that organization, mm-hmm. South Bronx Churches, East Brooklyn Congregation. Because see, the next phase of that is they took the schools over, you know, and then they're going to take the parks over, you know, and they want control of that community. So they, yeah, to answer the question, they know Jesus. But your first observation is absolutely correct. You know, he must have been in the office. Right. We're working on two different planes. Evangelism's doing something else, and social ministry's doing something else. There is a vein within the church that's working together, but unfortunately they're not the real power brokers. Like, for instance, this organizing group and the seminary presidents are now, not only do they want the seminary, each seminary to be required to go to training, they want their whole staff to go through a 2 or 3 day orientation on power organizing. What that means. So there's folks that, you know, start to realize that we need to create a type of theology that speaks to that.
One of the things we always said on that board, when we would know that there were more letters of people complaining about the way we were trying to figure out the best use of the church's dollars, you know, to address issues of social concern. And, you know, the old cliche, you know, you give a person a fish and they eat for a day, you teach them to fish and they eat for a lifetime. And the tagline of the unit is to each according to their needs, which is pretty radical when you think about it. So, but as a board, people really struggled by it, with what was the best use of the church's money. And obviously we come down on the side of supporting Gaylord's work. But I think it's an interesting question. I don't know, you think about it in your local communities. What does it mean to be the church in our society today? Do we have responsibility? If you've done this under the least of these, you've done it under me, you know, so does the least of these have to know that it's the church that's benefiting them or helping them?
People like Jody Cressman have been out there for a while. They take that to another level. You can feed them, give a person food, feed them for a day, teach them how to fish, feed them for a lifetime. Well, now we're at the level that we're gonna buy the pond and stock it. We're gonna feed the whole community. I mean, that's the reality. We're gonna guarantee it. I mean, that's where we are now. You know, we've gone to level 3. I think the movie's ready. The power's on.
Catch you all time.
Yeah.
place is San Antonio, Texas, and the event is called Action. Representatives from congregations throughout San Antonio have gathered to pressure the mayor to make good on a promise of badly needed funds for job training. The people gathered here belong to COPS, Communities Organized for Public Service. COPS is one of a growing number of church-based community organizations in our nation. And local politicians are not only listening to what these powerful groups have to say, but increasingly, they are taking concrete action on their behalf.
Mass-based community organizations have been in existence for a long time. What became different about a church-based community organization was that instead of going to neighborhood centers, neighborhood associations, it went to the church to find its point of support. Community organizing is part of the tradition of the church's ministry, right from the very beginning of the church. It began with the development of hospitals. It was clearly involved in the development of the public school system. It's been involved in the development of homes for the aging. It's clearly a concern for now jobs for people and economic development of communities. It is clearly involved in the area of giving people greater sense of political control over their own lives. Lutherans have probably been, of all denominations, the most effective institutionalizer of caring for people. But that's like my Good Samaritan story of someone saying, isn't it wonderful that the highway has a dangerous curve, because every time a person drives around the curve and has an accident, we fill up our hospital. But what is needed in our society is someone to straighten up the highway. And what we're trying to do with systemic change, with community organizations that causes for the problem, is to bring about change that will eliminate the problem.
Our cities, our communities, our neighborhoods are dying, if not dead in some ways. The church, it seems to me, has a witness, has a responsibility to help rekindle life and hope for the people who live in those communities and cities and the schools. And they have to develop a strategy to do so. Otherwise, the gospel has no meaning. If it does not inspire, if it does not comfort, if it does not challenge, if it does not give hope to people. And one of the strategies that makes sense to me is one of teaching people how to organize, how to develop congregation-based, church-based organization, which teaches people about public life, which teaches people how to do business, how to negotiate with power, how to challenge power if necessary, how to, you know, collaborate with power if necessary, to seek the welfare of the city.
I think it's very important to draw the distinction in political involvement between partisan politics and the political life of the people. And church-based organizing, by its nature, is never involved in partisan politics. But we exercise our own judgment in terms of our own self-interest as church people who live in cities and in rural areas, as to how we view the sign of the kingdom of God being lived out in particular legislative actions, relationships with banks, with industries, with unions. And that's the public life. I think Lutheran theology is very strong on the fact that Christianity and the gospel does not bring an individual personalized salvation. It always draws us into community, always into corporate life.
As ministers, men and women, come into churches in Chicago and across the country, is that they've been prepared to come into a community that's there, that's organized. And they've been prepared to marry the lovers and bury their dead and baptize their babies and minister to folks who are ill. And they know how to do that. They now have the skills to do that. But what they're walking into is fractured communities.
A number of our pastors are deeply frustrated and in great consternation when they come into a parish, and it is not a whole community. It's a fragmented, fractured community, and it's frustrated by economics and a whole host of things that we are unprepared to deal with.
the problem with families being dislocated by the decisions made in Congress and other places about timber cutting and what happens in preservation of the natural resources, the spotted owl and so forth, were impacting a number of communities in our Synod. It's a long-term effort because it is not just about timber and owls. It's about changing lifestyles, changing economies, and one with which the church is going to have to cope if it understands its mission not just for the next world, but God impacting lives here and now as well. And this church-based community organizing is not another thing to do. I think this is the greatest moment to be in mission we may have had for over 100 years. That may be the most gracious gift that society and God is giving to us to say, and now it is time for the church to step up and be the church. You're not guaranteed a spot here. You are called into a mission and to a ministry in the midst of this place that is God's world, but has alien forces at work.
In many communities that we work in, the church is the only institution left. The school has gone, the post office is gone, the businesses are gone, and we really have, for the last 10 years, have created a wasteland in rural America. It is not safe in rural America anymore. We've become a haven for drug dealers who know that there isn't the kind of police protection out there. We are far apart geographically, so they can set up crack labs, and do. My entire community knows where the drug dealers live, who they are, they're afraid of them. It's really not safe. The pastoral idea, you drive through and it's very beautiful, but underneath that is a pervading disquiet, and all the problems that you find in the city, they're just not as apparent when you drive through rural America. Our suicide rate is astronomical. Domestic violence, alcohol, and drug abuse, the rates are equal with or greater than inner cities in this country.
There's a number of things that are happening throughout Appalachia that are church-based community organizing. They are ecumenical in nature. I think that we found out in Appalachia that you don't have the luxury of being in isolation. In every community there are people of hope and people of faith. And that one thing that church-based community organizing does is brings people together to talk about their hope and faith. And so then that hope and faith begins to be shared and owned by the community. And that is a beautiful thing to have happen. And then we begin to live out of hope instead of living out of despair.
This whole endeavor begins with one person. It doesn't begin with a congregation. It doesn't even begin with a committee. It begins with one person at least who has a vision. What do you see when you walk out your door? You need to see people whose potential is only minimally being realized. That far more than what's wrong with the community, than the various social ills like drugs and crime and bad housing, unemployment. You need to see people who have inherent powerfulness as a gift from God. So it doesn't depend upon a congregation's commitment up front. It depends upon a host of people talking with each other, started maybe by just one person. When that congregation commits itself to want to be doing something as a change agent in its community, then they need to realize, and they soon will realize, that they cannot do it alone, that they need to be banded together with other congregations. Not because people aren't well-intentioned, not because they're not well-motivated,
not because they aren't even competent and capable, but because the challenge is so overwhelming that it needs a connectional strategy, an interfaith strategy, a broad-based strategy, one which understands the realities of power. That's got to be guided by someone who is professional, someone who's got some experience and some capability and a track record. The kind of expertise, the kind of talent, the kind of anger, the kind of vision that organizers bring from whatever network is the kind of catalyst then that can make a group of people who are well-intended become truly powerful. This is a poor neighborhood, but there's sort of a veneer of things looking okay. Underneath that are all of the kinds of destructive elements of urban poverty that exist in any major city in the country. There's terrible violence, growing violence, deep drug addictions. There's a lot of despair. What MICA does for the church is enable the church to focus on those issues that are important to people. MICA stands for Milwaukee Inner City Congregations Alliance for Hope. It's church-based organization of 32 congregations currently interfaith. It'll probably be 40 within a year. Lutheran, Roman Catholic, Baptist, Church of God in Christ, AME, Episcopal, Society of Friends, Presbyterian. And we function now around four major problem areas: housing, education, drug/crime, and economic development. In the area of economic development, for example, we won passage of a 14% ordinance that mandates that at least 14% of worker hours on Department of Public Works contracts be done by unemployed residents of the inner city. That means several hundred jobs a year to the inner city that wouldn't otherwise be there.
Our church is gaining strength from that also. People take leadership roles who probably never thought they had any leadership ability. I've seen people who said they've never spoken in public before speak before hundreds of people. Nervous? Yeah, to begin with, but then they just grow and grow and grow.
I've never been no big talker, only with my kids. Have to be. But now I can get up and speak the way I feel and feel comfortable about it. I have been without a house, nice, decent house, but I still pay a fortune for rent. And that's my main goal, is to see that people get decent houses.
I was really gone. I was down. I was deeply depressed. I was paranoid because I was not only using, I was selling too. I had hit rock bottom. I was separated from my family, physically and emotionally, because to me, I was emotionally dead. I couldn't care for anyone and I couldn't trust anyone. If you had what I wanted right then, you were just out of luck. One of the things Mike has done that changed me now, it taught me that I can take charge of my life and make a difference. I heard not too long ago that Mike had a crime drug task force. And this is something I really wanted to get into because it gave me a chance, you know, to feel that I was doing something, you know, trying to make a change. This is something very dear to me. Because if I can have it, I want you to have it. You know? And it just overwhelms me to be able to just help somebody. I can look my kids in the eye and tell them, you know, this isn't right, or that isn't right, and I feel like a hypocrite.
Micah is already a very known force and respected force in the city in a very short time. I've seen how it's begun to work and begin to change, introducing a sense of hope, a sense of working together.
that has very real impact on the congregation. It means that we've got an access to leadership training that is first rate. Our meetings are run more efficiently. We have more of a reservoir of leadership for running the congregation. We've had over 30 people in the congregation go to day-long training locally. We've used those 30 people for interviewing teams to do evangelism visits and to interview every member of the congregation. We used our interviewing team to do our every member visitation stewardship a year and a half ago. And we realized last year in 1991 a $10,000 increase in offering plate giving. This is from a congregation that has a majority of membership that is poor, and the rest is blue collar. There are only a few middle class members. So that's and it's 206 baptized, 130 confirmed. That's a substantial increase in giving. Church-based organizing for me it's a vehicle for justice in the city. It's also evangelism to the extent that it brings good news to lives of people and releases the sense of their own power, their own dignity, and their own inner worth, and claims really the image of God and the renewed image of Christ that's within people and summons them to community, to control over their lives and control over their neighborhoods, because it's very grassroots, it's incredibly democratic. And it's rooted in the values and strength of churches and has enormous potential. Maybe then in 15 years the church-based organizing will begin to impact the national arena.
Real quick, three quick points. I appreciate you. I'm sorry for running over. Three quick points. One of the things I failed to mention is that one of the laws of organizing, don't do anything for anybody that they can do for themselves. The second part of it is that it's very relational, and one of the gifts and skill levels that we learn from organizing is evaluation. Constant, thorough evaluation. I mean, after meetings, the conference we had in Daytona, the conference we had down in San Antonio, every evening, whatever time we got through, we had to go in a room and evaluate and change and adjust things as we went. That's critical. Anyway, thank you. Time's run out. Appreciate it.
Thank you.